Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NBB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, so offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on our front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like to find it, you simply need to enter the URL. To find it, just type in puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. Question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NBB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the TechNet or via email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Bob, KD2NBB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. Bob KD2NBB, looking forward to good net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I'm trying a little something different. I'm actually going into EchoLink via another computer tonight. So I'm going around the entrance that I usually go through that's having some technical problems that hopefully I'll be able to solve soon. Anyway, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each and every month at 9 p.m., hopefully to answer technical questions. It doesn't really work well if no one asks any questions or brings up any topics. So if there's anyone out there with a question about amateur radio or technology, please hit that push your talk button, give us your first name and your call sign, and we'll make up a little list.
AD2DU.
Alex recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Please hit that push to talk button, or whatever works as a push to talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign.
Hey, Roy, this is Max, KD2VEA. I have a question for later.
Time goes on, there'll be a few more people with a few more questions. What's your question for tonight, Alex?
So I got a U-loop antenna that AirSpy makes for a shortwave radio. Like, it's a small, circle of coax, and it's got a connector on top and a connector at the bottom. Not coax, it's smaller than that, but it says to vary the frequency that it receives better. You can squish the antenna shape into an oval or leave it as a circle, and they're different things. I want to know, like, do you move it up or move it down if you squish it, or can you control it, or do you just feel it out? 82 to you.
Gosh, I think that this is just kind of a loop that's flexible, right? I just had to pull it up because it's not really anything that I ever heard anyone use before. It's sort of a magnetic loop, I guess. Don't know exactly what the parameters and what it's really meant to do and how it's meant to do it. A true magnetic loop operates somewhat differently. It operates, it's a shortened, it acts like a shortened dipole, and it requires a massive capacitor to tune it to resonance. And if you change frequency, it changes, it gets out of resonance, so you have to retune it. So this looks to me to be just a loop antenna that's just made out of flexible stuff, unless it has some extra passive component on it. What is its frequency range that it came with in the documentation, if you got any documentation?
So I didn't really delve into the forums or I could find or whatever yet. It sells as a shortwave antenna for a shortwave radio, but I guess it can squish to the VHF spectrum and pick up airband too if you squish it. But I didn't know if there was a method to the madness, or do you just kind of have to screw around?
Okay, I'm looking it up on websites. Not a lot of great responses. One guy who's upset because the connectors broke off after about the first month. I don't know. It doesn't strike me it's the best antenna for anything, unfortunately. You have to understand that the realities in life is the laws of physics make you pay a price for any compromise. And this seems to be the ultimate compromise antenna I've ever seen, which is saying a lot. So theoretically, I guess, you just kind of move it around and hope for the best. I wouldn't expect a heck of a lot. You might be able to receive something because receivers are incredibly more tolerant than transmitters, but this most likely is nothing close to a transmitting antenna, because you will never have a 1-to-1 or even a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The reflections would knock out the transmitter of any transceiver I can think of. So it's purely a receiving antenna of very dubious efficiency. So it's the only thing tunable, as far as I can perceive, as you mentioned, is to just kind of twist and turn the somewhat circular leads into more of an ellipse. It'll be an interesting little experiment. I don't think it's going to be terribly successful based upon what I'm reading in the reviews. It seems to be a quick and dirty receiving antenna, and I would hope that you would be looking more for a transmitting antenna in the future.
It's just a fun toy that I had laying around, and it really ties the room together, paint, you know, taped up to the wall with blue painter's tape all over it. AD2DU.
AC2GS. Well, look, it's an experience. It's one that most of the other hams that I know of don't have, so you're in the minority there, but that's good. You're looking at the different options. I would be very curious to find out from you what, if anything, you are able to receive given that antenna. Again, it's a very, very, very compromised receive-only antenna, and putting it inside the house as opposed to outside the house is going to compromise it even more. You might be able to pick up things. That's the beauty and the difference between a transmitter and a receiver. Receivers not require a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. They benefit from it. It's more efficient transfer of energy from the antenna system to the receiver's front end. But theoretically, you could have as much as a 10-to-1 mismatch, And because receivers function with microvolts of RF power coming in, they're very, very forgiving. So I hope you have luck with it. And I must say, I am curious about if you've tried it out, have you been able to pick up any signals, and what kind of signals have you been able to pick up?
It seems to pick up, like, AM stations in the 6 megahertz area pretty well. I don't know. Can I use a rig expert on it? Will that tell me anything? Or is that only for transmit antennas?
Well, yeah, you can plug the rig expert vector network analyzer into it. And again, I'll be very curious to know what it would show you. My guess is it would not have any kind of definitive resonant dip anywhere in the HF frequencies. Judging from what I can assume those lengths, the diameter of the thing is, it says it's a 60 centimeter diameter, that it's probably resonant someplace in UHF or VHF, but it probably isn't resonant anywhere near the HF band. But it'll be curious to see. You can plug anything that thinks it's an antenna into a rig expert. Occasionally people will come on the technical net and they'll tell me that they plugged in their handy talkies with the antenna and were very confused because it didn't seem to be terribly resonant. That's, among other things, due to the fact that the whip antenna of a handy talkie is using you as the counterpoise when you're holding on to the handy talkie. And most people who are testing a whip antenna on something like a rig expert are not giving it a counterpoise, and so getting completely different results. But yes, the short answer is yes, you can plug it into the rig expert. And again, I'd be curious what it would show.
I'll figure it out. I'll see what I can think. It's because I keep a shortwave radio next to the bed to fall asleep to.
Okay. I wish you luck with it, Alex. And again, if you want to send me an image from the rig expert, you can plug those things into computers and download scans and all kinds of things. So if you're able to do that and you want to, feel free to email it to me. I'm always curious about all these things, and I hope you have some good luck with it. Like I said, this is kind of the first time I particularly saw this. There are such things as magnetic loops, which are very shortened loops, where the length of the circumference is approximately one-tenth of wavelength. But again, those require more sophisticated electronics. They require a separate driving coil or a match that feeds the magnetic loop and offers some impedance transformation, and usually a large tuning capacitor at either the top or the bottom where the gap is, which this one doesn't seem to have. So very curious. What the hell, you already have it, so you might as well learn something from it. So if you could share it with the rest of us, I'd appreciate it. Anything else tonight, Alex?
Didn't catch all that last transmission. It made it dropped out on you. Over.
Okay, hopefully this won't drop out. Yeah, it did drop out. How do you like that? Gosh, I don't know what's the matter with it. Anyway, I was just wondering if there was anything else that, any question or comment that you might have tonight, Alex?
No, I'll play around with it and see what I can figure out. I do have an AN200 loop for AM reception on the shortwave that works great. You pick up stations from all over, and it's pretty unintrusive. But, yeah, interested to see what other questions folks have. 82 to you.
Okay, very good, Alex. Thank you for participating. There's a little bit of a blinkiness that goes on with this setup, so I hope people will forgive it. Anyway, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at 9 p.m., going for as long as it needs to go. So if there's anyone out there with any questions or topics for discussion tonight, then please feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
Good evening, Roy. This is KG2VEA. I'm on Echolink.
Yes, I see you, Max. I'm staring at Echolink as I speak.
Yeah, doing a little housework, so not close to my radio. But I do have a question around audio connectors for K-type. Let me just come up for a second. So here's my question, if you can hear it. If it's hard to do over echoing, I'll get back to my radio. But I have an Anytone 878DU, and I have a microphone, external microphone, and there's a connector on the side. It's a Kenwood K-type connector, which I would assume is just basically a stereo plug for the headphones and a plug for the microphone. And for a net, I'm thinking of bringing back the ARRL News, and for that, I was playing it to the speaker, but it gets echoey, so I was thinking, why not just play it from my phone to the radio? And I was thinking it might be just as simple as getting a wire, an input jack, and putting it into supposedly the microphone part of the K connector, putting in the output of my phone connector and playing that. When I started looking online, I don't see anybody doing that, nothing at all mentioned. So I was wondering, is that something that's going to break my radio if I try something like that? Is that as simple as I'm thinking it is? What do you think?
Well, it's not quite as simple as you think it might be, because you're putting a voltage potential with a particular impedance to another device's circuits without knowing what the matching impedance are and what the voltage ratings are. So theoretically, it's relatively easy to blow out something doing exactly what you consider doing. Now, it might be doable, and again, although you haven't seen it yet by Googling it, I would suggest you might consider continuing in your Googling. I would think it would be a wee bit easier. The way that I do things like that is through a signal link box. It's a little bit more expensive because they match the settings better, and you have a middleman between things that doesn't upset something like this. So theoretically, you could possibly get a signal link and hook it up to your radio, and you can feed the audio into it through a computer not have to worry about impedance matching and power level balancing, unless you find some very good documentation on how to do it in a safe way that won't blow up your radio.
That is very interesting. Can you tell me a little bit more about the signaling box? What's the purpose? Is it just an audio device in the middle? Like, how does it match impedance? Like, what's the purpose of it in the design? Like, how is it any different from a wire going from my device to straight to the radio?
Well, as far as I know, it's a lot more forgiving. Consumer devices kind of have usually unpublished ranges, where if you go beyond the voltage potential or if you have a significant impedance mismatch, they tend to be less forgiving because they're not really designed for active components. Your cell phone is kind of not really designed, as far as I'm aware, for line inputs and line outputs. They're more looking for maybe a line output, but the line input is usually calibrated for something more like a microphone. So in the case of Signal Link, is basically an audio sound card interface between radios and USB connectors for any kind of computer. It acts as its own separate audio device and a sound card. So if you need more than one sound card, and you only get one for most part in your PC, this is a way of hooking up multiple audio feeds from radios into your computer so you can process them, record them, or spit them out through IceCast like I do. I have particularly found that Signalink is a good brand. It's RF shielded. It comes with different adapters for different radios. There's one that I have hooked up to my TYT, which is the same exact connection that the Anytone 878 takes. And it just makes for a safer interface. You know, it's not going to kill the interface. It's not going to kill my computer. It's not going to kill the radio. Whereas, you know, if the levels aren't quite in the right range, you might blow out some circuit in your cell phone, and I don't think you'd want to do that.
That's interesting. Thank you. So I will check it out for Signalink. Does it, because I was kind of looking a little bit at FT8 and those, and for now I only have, I haven't really tried to connect it to the 10 meter radio. I haven't really had good luck with my antennas. If I wanted to try FT8 on 2 meter or 70 centimeter, which my Anytone produces, would I be able to do this with the Signalink as well? Would that give me that ability?
Yeah, if you could find FT8 being sent, I've never really looked on UHF, VHF. It tends to be, I think, designed more with HF, but yeah, you could try. But yeah, what it will do is FT8 basically decodes an audio tone. So the Signalink will be able to patch the audio output of your radio and insert it into the computer. My only problem is, does your radio output in the right format? I would think your radio is primarily FM modulated. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. I think Anytone, Anytone 878, I think it's only FM modulated. So you're right. Is the, for FT8, that has to be, what's the upper sideband only, right? I don't know what I'm talking about. But you're right. I think Anytone is only FM modulated. Kind of a follow-up question. So I'm using Selvin's old Kenwood TS-80, I believe. I'll probably be able to use this link, this device as well to try actually FT8 on that 10 meter. Actually, I have better luck getting on it with FT8 and those low power modes than I've been trying to do with audio. Yeah, just curious.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it wouldn't work with frequency modulation. FT8 is an amplitude modulated signal, so upper sideband would work. AM might work. I've never really used AM, but you know, I can't see any particular reason why it shouldn't. It just needs to get that stream of audio signals, and then the computer does the rest. And you could use the same signal link for both radios, except that you would, of course, need a different adapter, because I'm sure they have different connections. Also, there's a little logic of where the signals come and go that depends sometimes on the type of radio you have. They sell these little PC boards that plug in that connect certain input options to output options. So you might need two modules for the two different radios if you want full control, you know, push to talk and such to go on.
Okay, that sounds interesting. That gives me a good idea, because I was really surprised when I found, because I figured somebody would have had a wire or something like that and would have been an easy description on how to get a HD to transmit something that's pre-recorded. But yeah, that was, plus as I found, there's a cable for the Baofengs, basically does that. It's an APRS and something, but does not say that it works for Anytone. I found nothing on Anytone, but I was going to submit a ticket with them, but then I think they could void my warranty, so that would be fun. But I'm going to try it out. Probably start first with trying to get the ARL in use, and then I'm going to do some research to see if you connect the CAN with. I don't have to operate them at the same time, just be able to, if I'm playing with one or the other, to be able to connect and actually transmit through those modes. That's really interesting. Thank you, Roy. This is KD2VEA. I don't have any other questions. I'm going to let others ask, and then if I remember something else, I will come back.
Okay, very good. You keep on checking in Google. You never know. You know, it's not impossible. It depends upon how safe you want to be. If you wanted to be really safe, the best thing would be some kind of isolation circuit, so that current from one device isn't touching the other. You know, some opto isolator in the middle of maybe an op amp. That would be a little on the sophisticated electronic side. Some people will just put a impedance matching transformer between the two with maybe a current limiting resistor and adjust the resistance as the need fit. So, you know, there are kludges out there, but keep in mind that the kludgier they are, the more damage that they're capable of doing down the road. So do a good hard Google search, and you may yet see. I mean, Anytone 878s are ubiquitous. Everyone and their brother seems to have one on DMR. So it's not like you're the only person who owns one. So keep looking, and if you find something interesting, come back and tell us the story.
Will do. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you for participating. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club's technical band. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m., hopefully to offer some answers and suggestions to people about amateur radio technology. None of us knew this stuff going in. We all had to learn it, and so everyone likes to pass it forward and give back to the community. So, if you're out there and you got a question, please feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Well, I heard a few chunks of the repeater, but I heard a few chunks of the repeater, but not much else, so I'm not quite sure if someone was trying to get in and failed, or someone just wanted a kerchunk to repeater. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS Roy here. If you got any questions or topics for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, maybe this is going to be a real short night. You never know. We'll try one more time, and if no one has any question, I guess we'll move on to the TechNet puzzle. But before we hit the TechNet puzzle, and it doesn't require any illustration, it's all text. So, you know, if you could find it on the website, it's available on a link from the front page, or you can just type in puzzle.kc2rc.com. But before we get to the puzzle, I'll ask one more time if anyone out there has any questions, technical questions that they would like to ask tonight. If so, give us your first name and your call sign.
Hey, Roy. If nobody else joins, I would rather do tech puzzle first, but I probably would want to come back and talk a little bit about the Wires X piece that I wanted to talk about a couple of weeks ago after.
Okay. We can do the puzzle first, and then we'll come back to your question. Let's see. We have the question is basically, during a typical 24-hour period, when does ionization have the least effect on radio signals? And you got four choices. A is around midnight. B is just before daybreak. C is around noon. And D is just after sunset. So does anyone wish to hazard a guess when during a typical 24-hour period does ionization have the least effect on radio signals?
D2NVB, I think I know the probable answer, but see if anyone else wants to try.
I mean, I would venture an answer as well. So I'm going to throw it out, I think, right before daybreak. Let's see what other answers are there. This is KKGT2BEA.
Okay, very good. Bob, do you want to offer your suggestion?
K2NVB. Yeah, I would say C around noon. I think that's my understanding. Back to you.
AC2GS. No, maybe you misunderstood the question, Bob. The point is, when does ionization have the least effect on radio signals? Around noon would probably be the most effect, because what's going on is the sun is overhead, and the ultraviolet energy and cosmic rays are hitting the ionosphere and energizing them and causing them to become more active. So the later after the sun sets, the better as far as low ionization. It's like a battery that gets discharged over time. So Maxim was correct. It's just before daybreak, again, because it's the energy of the sun coming up that activates the ionosphere, or more activates it to one degree or another. Sunspot activity even activates it even greater. So yeah, the answer is B, just before daybreak.
K2NVB. I thought more ionization meant better conditions. I thought was at night and the worst during noon. So I guess I didn't know exactly what ionization meant. Back to you.
Yeah, I understand. That's one of the things that when I was taking the exams, I kind of read the question twice, although I had read the question a dozen times before that, just to make sure because sometimes we misinterpret the question, then we answer the wrong question and get the wrong answer. So yeah, in the case of this question, the way that they worded it was, during a typical 24-hour period, when does ionization have the least effect? So ionization has the least effect when there's the least ionization, and that's the middle of the night. It has the greatest effect when the ionization is the greatest in a 24-hour period, which is midday. So yeah, it's sometimes you have to kind of translate the question is a little bit better into English, so you know exactly what question you're being asked, as opposed to what question you'd like to be asked.
So I had it backwards.
What can I say? It happens to the best of us, Bob. There's always the question for March 8th that I'll post at the end of the night.
That ionization meant the condition where, where the radio signals will bounce off the top of the ionosphere and can travel farther. I thought that was more ionization, but I guess that's less ionization.
Again, it's a problem with the wording of the question, but the way that they're asking it is, when is there the least amount of ionization going on in a 24-hour cycle? It probably would have been better if that's what the question was, but the question I pulled out of the internet was what I just said. So a little bit difficult to interpret, I understand, but what can I tell you?
Yeah, so I guess ionization is a thing that makes radio communication worse, and I thought it was what made it bounce better. Okay, so I didn't know the meaning of ionization, I guess.
No, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated. Ionization is when gases have a electron kicked out, and they become charged particles. And so when they're charged, they reflect and refract and disperse radio waves. For 20 and 10 and 15 and 6 meters, high levels of ionization are good because they produce a refractory belt around the Earth and back to the Earth instead of going to outer space. In the cases of 40 and to a greater extent 80 and to a greater extent 160 meters, ionization is principally detrimental. There's already enough ionization of the D layer. If it's the slightest bit more active, like during the day, what happens is, in addition to refracting 80 meters, it refracts a lot of background noise. So the noise floor goes up much higher than the signal does. And so you can't really communicate well on 80 and 160 in the middle of the day. You have to wait at night when the ionosphere calms down a lot and the F1 and F2 kind of fades away, and the D layer, although it's always there to one degree or another, is much more quiescent and produces a great deal less background noise for the band.
So around noon is good for 10 meters and 6 meters. Is that true? That's the best time of day for them? Or is that it? Back to you.
Yes. You'll find on 10 meters, as I do during the Sunday nets, I'll turn the radio on 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, and you'll hear a lot of European stations. You won't hear too many local stations. You certainly won't hear anyone on the West Coast or the Midwest. And when we start the 11 o'clock, you start to pick up a couple of Midwest stations, and then by about 12, 12:30, you'll pick up a lot more on the West Coast. So approximately middle of the day is the best time, but, you know, depending upon where you want to talk to. If you really want to talk to Europe, you're probably better off doing it earlier because their ionosphere is also lit up. So it depends on what other portion of the globe you're interested in of when the best time during daylight is. Once the sun goes down locally, your ionosphere is bleeding energy, and you know you can't get out of your local environment for the most part. Depends on how highly charged it is. Every so often there are conditions that allow you to have DX past 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But midday, early afternoon, late morning, that's usually the best.
That's all interesting. It's like, so is there a direct answer to this? Is like, or maybe it's not always the same answer. Is it more important for the conditions, the time of day, to be optimal for the transmitter or the receiver? Probably the transmitter, right?
Well, there's such a thing as reciprocity. Usually, all things being equal, if your power output is the same as the other station's power output, and the noise floor is approximately the same on both sides, if you can hear them, they can hear you, and so things are somewhat reciprocal. So it's probably a little bit of both. You have to consider that it's the path that counts. So the same path that you take to get to him is the same path he'll use to get to you, only in the reverse direction. So it's not a case of the transmitter being more, location being more important than the receiver.
Actually, thinking about it, now I'm thinking, of course, it must be the position that's exactly halfway or something like that, exactly in between the two, where the bounce happens.
Well, to a degree, but probably all things being equal, it's probably best, and it's close to the most western of the two operators, because you still have some residual charge and you still have the sun up in the sky, whereas they might not. So, you know, depending upon where you are, like when I talk to people in Washington State, if it's too early, it might be close to midday, but it's the sun is just going up there. So probably not optimally at the midpoint between the two stations. It's probably optimal a little bit off-center towards the more western. Court Station.
Of course, this is, we're talking about the higher HF bands. I guess it's kind of the reverse for the lower HF bands, right?
Yeah, once again, the lower HF bands do best in the middle of the night. They do not do well when the sun is in the sky. So, yeah, it would be the exact opposite. Because there's a different system going on. You already have the necessary refractions of 80 and 160 because they refract at a lower ionization level at a lower band. The higher frequencies require higher ionospheres with higher energy bands to do that refracting, and they don't introduce as much noise to the signal as 80 and 160 has noise introduced it by a overactive D ionosphere band around the Earth.
Right, so this sunspot cycle getting more active is actually, I ever just say this, yeah, for those lower bands, is actually makes it worse. But for many of us, of course, it's easier to do the higher bands because you don't need as big an antenna, you don't need as much space, et cetera, et cetera. That's basically it, right?
AC2GS, yes. Most of the excited, happy amateur radio operators during sunspot maximums are people who operate on 10 and 6, you know, 6 they call the magic band. The band lights up from nowhere, and you can talk a lot of different places all over the world. The guys, when we're kind of jumping up and down, celebrating the sunspot cycle, you'll notice that the 80 and 160 meter guys do not join in. It really doesn't help them, and to a degree, it might hinder them a little bit. So they're not that thrilled about sunspot cycles. You know, occasionally you've got clever people who spend a lot of their time during the sunspot maximums, 20 and 10 and 6, and then during the minimums they go down to 80 and 40. But a lot of times people just have favorites and they kind of stick where they want to stick.
I would think, like, if you're a guy who has room for a 80 or 160 meter antenna, then it's child's play to put up a 10 and 20 meter antenna in addition, so it's not as big a deal. And I guess the way you're talking, maybe the high sunspot cycle is not as bad for 80 and 160 as the low sunspot cycle is for like 10 or 6. Is that true?
Yeah, it might introduce a slightly higher noise floor, so some signals that could just get by during sunspot minimums won't on the maximums, but because of the variability of signals in general, that's not easily perceived. It's more of a nuisance to people who go to 80 and 160 as opposed to during the sunspot minimums. It knocks out the F1 and F2 layer and pretty much locks you down to local communications, except for the odd occasional DX. Like we used to regularly stay within New Jersey, Queens, Staten Island. There would always be kind of once a month a guy from Florida who had a big tower and a big beam, and somehow he got through, but that was an unusual thing. So it's night and day, if you will, for 6 meters and 10 meters, as opposed to 80 and 160, where it's just a minor nuisance that they deal with.
Right, got it. So definitely more hams are more happy during high sunspot cycles. Back to you.
Again, it sort of depends on what you like. If you're into 10 meters, which I am, that is great. There are some guys who just kind of live on 80. You can listen to them almost every night. It sounds like they sit there with their feet up on a soapbox and chat away with guys that they've been chatting away with for 30 years, and that's their idea of heaven. So, you know, if you offer them a couple extra sunspot maximums, they would say thanks but no thanks. So, you know, and then there's a whole bunch of guys who don't even venture onto HF. They have a Baofeng, and they stay on UHF and VHF. So it depends what you like.
Right, right. And of course, all my the local me being unable to reach you via 10 meters with a mag loop in my Faraday apartment, that don't change. Has nothing to do with any of that sunspot cycle stuff.
Well, yes, because we're dealing with ground wave propagation. So ground wave propagation isn't affected by the ionosphere. And the problem is that sky wave propagation requires a certain distance. One of the reasons why it's very difficult to impossible to talk to people on the rest of Long Island in Nassau and Suffolk County is because if you think of the takeoff angle of our radio waves and then bouncing back to Earth, it skips right over Long Island and such. So skip areas aren't good for sky wave by ionospheric propagation either. So those are the real difficult ones where you can't get them on the ground wave because there's too many local obstructions, and you can't get them in the sky wave because they're too close to us for a skip.
Right, right. Yeah, it's right in the... in the, what you call it, the trough of the wave. Well, that's not really what it is, but you know what I mean. So when it's there, that the wave is up there somewhere in the ionosphere, not down at their antenna.
Yep, it doesn't count if it's up in the ionosphere when it reaches your location. It has to hit your antenna to work.
Yeah, just kind of, I wonder if it's, I guess depending on the angle of your antenna, I guess, yeah, people usually try to go the farthest, but I guess you could point the antenna up. I guess it's too close an angle to try to bounce up to go to Long Island. I guess you need some kind of like a fraction of 1 degree off of straight up or something. It'd just be too fiddly to do, I guess.
Well, you have to keep in mind that this is not what we call isotropic. Isotropic radiation is what an incandescent light bulb does, you know, 360 degrees all over the place. These things bouncing off the ionosphere are not tropospheric, so you can't just take a Yagi and point it straight up when it's kind of at its highest point, getting refracted on the ionosphere and ready to come back down on the Earth, say, 500 miles past you and be able to pick up the signal, because the signal isn't like an incandescent bulb that's shining in every direction. It's kind of at that point shining in a very narrow beam going, getting refracted through the ionosphere.
If you say refracted all the time, I guess everybody says that. That's the same thing as, I mean, I think maybe I'm picturing it like shooting billiards, and it's probably not that clean. When it hits the ionosphere, does it just come down like another straight line or something close to that?
No, and that's why I keep on saying the word refracted, because people tend to be sloppy and they say reflected. And part of it is reflected. Part of it is reflected off. The point is that when the ionosphere charges up, it has a different optical density. It has a, you know, it's like the difference between water and glass or air and water or such. And so the light will bend. So as it, some of it will reflect off the surface of that difference, but a lot of it will travel through the ionosphere and get bent, the way that a prism bends light. And so it's refraction, reflection, and to a degree dispersion that goes on in the ionosphere. So saying that it's just a reflection is kind of simplifying it a little too much for me.
Well, that sounds like it's good, because that means I'm guessing that would mean it gets spread out more, so it comes out more like shot it up like a .22, it might come down more like a shotgun. Is that true?
Well, I don't know exactly how much it spreads things out. There is the reflective the amount that's bounced back through pure reflection is probably a much lower percentage, but at least it gives you a little bit of a spread between the reflected signal and the refracted signal.
Of course, I guess there's no free lunch, so it's spread out wider, but of course it gets weaker every time it does that at the same time, but it's diluted.
Yep, as physicists say, there is no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah, I think I have a good picture of it now. Yeah, kind of basically what I had before, but it fine-tunes it a bit. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. That's what I'm here for. So, anyone out there, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We try and answer your technical questions, or at least give you some suggestions. So if you're out there and you have any questions tonight, please feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign.
Hey, Roy. This is Max, KD2VEA. Just wanted to run my rudimentary understanding of wires X by you just to make sure I didn't miss something. You up for that?
Certainly.
All right. Ready then. So just looking through our equipment that we're trying to place. So my understanding of it is basically this. We are connecting to the repeater through our radios using analog communication. What we also have is another transceiver, which is listening to the repeater and communicating with the repeater, just the same way that I or anyone else is connected to the repeater. As it receives information, there's another module connected to that transceiver that converts that into a digital signal and then basically sends that digitized audio stream to a digital quote-unquote room, which is, I guess, this WiresX platform, whatever you want to call it, implementation. So one is that rudimentary understanding accurate? And two what's the difference between WiresX and DMR? Because I feel like that kind of works in exactly the same way. Just curious, let me know.
Yes, you have it perfectly right. It is Yaesu's fusion version of D-Star's reflectors or Motorola's DMR talk groups. What it amounts to is it's a proprietary server rack owned by Yaesu. So they have a digital voice backbone. Anyone who buys an HRI 200 can have a room on their server. We call it KC2RC, and it will insert audio. I think it prefers to insert the digital stream into the internet, to the server, and it routes it into our room. And anyone who uses a WiresX with another repeater can then do it in the opposite direction. They select the KC2RC room, and they transmit, and their digital stream is fed into the server and then sent back to the HRI device that Mitch has and perhaps William will soon have. And then your radio plays it to your repeater, because that's the only way to get it to the repeater. And then anything on the radio is sent in the opposite direction to the servers. For the most part, I think Yaesu prefers pure digital streams. They do not really like to deal with analog voice signals. We tried years ago, and it locked up the machine, so we finally just gave up and set the HRI 200 purely for digital transmissions. No analogs allowed.
Okay, just want to clarify that last part. So what you're saying is that it's kind of like a secondary network with digital communication over our repeater rather than converting analog to digital?
Yes. Unfortunately, unless they've changed something, what happens if you try and use the analog signal to go through the room? It will lock up, or has in the past locked up, the HRI 200, and the whole room goes down, and you have to boot it back up. So we tried that repeatedly, and Joe, who was using it for us, finally just gave up and locked it into digital mode.
Got it. That's interesting. But at the same time, from what I remember, if digital communication is happening over the repeater through Wires X, at the same time, it still locks up the repeater. There's no audio communication happening, right?
Yeah, you can only have one signal. The way the radio is set up, you can't do both.
Okay, and specifically the conversation we had around this thing up, Mitch was concerned around having a smaller, less powerful antenna, he said, because then any other signal can overtake it and flood it. What does it mean exactly by that? Does that mean that if, let's say, I'm transmitting next to whichever the location is, then if I'm transmitting with more power, I will drown it out? And it's just basically that then Wires X wouldn't work? Like, what exactly do you mean by that?
I tend to think that Mitch was a bit too cautious. He was basing it on his experience in his house, which is significantly farther away from the repeater site. I would tend to think that William could set up a kind of a mediocre antenna, not a terrible one, but a somewhat mediocre one, because he's relatively very close to the repeater. So I think that that's less of a problem with him than it was with Mitch's location.
I see, yeah. So maybe it would be less of a problem. Well, we'll see if his wife gives him the go-ahead, and we'll be interested to see if this is something that we can do. Just was curious if I got it right, because I'm kind of trying to figure out if it's... Now we want to do it, but like, what is the urgency on that? If it's kind of something we want to get done quicker, or is it okay if we go back and forth, try to get it figured out? Well, sounds like we'll find out soon enough.
Yeah, I can't tell you how urgent it is. I assume really it isn't that urgent. I have kind of monitored this repeater for 6 months. The amount of activity I noticed on digital is negligible. I don't know how it was set up. I know it's now not set up anymore, because I used to have to remote into it to shut it down. In the very old days, it was problematic. People used to talking on the Fusion Net on Thursday night would come on to the Wires X room on Wednesday night and not have the faintest idea that we were having an analog net and just jam us. So I got into the habit of disabling the Fusion net room connection to our repeater. But I haven't heard any activity in 6 months. I could have missed it. There's probably more activity on the Echo Link. There's a couple of guys, one who lives in Florida, who talks to his friend usually Monday afternoons and such. So I don't think it's something you got to rush. I think it's best to plan it and make sure that you don't cause anyone to get a divorce or anything. And not the highest priority, not the lowest, someplace in the middle.
Point taken. I just was interested to see all about that. Well, thank you for answering that. I appreciate it. I think that answers all of my questions for now. Appreciate it.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I appreciate your participation. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. To discuss amateur radio technology, radios, antennas, electronics, all kinds of fun stuff. So if anyone out there has any particular questions that they feel like asking tonight, this would be a good time. Hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
D2ZKD, Theodore.
Yes, Theodore, what can I do for you tonight?
Through. I've been playing with my antenna for this entire net. The I've got a mini dipole set up now in a C configuration. It looks like I'm getting some weird propagation or reflections in the city. I'm not sure which. I'll fool around with it and circle back with some questions later on. I guess in the next, next TechNet. I got a question actually about non-soldering connections. I've been looking at the ARL handbook. I see information on soldering and crimping. What about wire wrapping? Do you guys use that?
Yeah, there are people who do wire wrapping. Wire wrapping is usually thought of as a preliminary to soldering. You don't have to, I guess, but it provides a little bit extra. Matter of fact, unfortunately, people kind of do that with crimping as well. You'll have a lot of people who will crimp and then they'll solder their crimp. Sometimes that's a little bit better, sometimes it's a little worse. It depends upon the type of connector and who is truly designed to have soldering. But theoretically, yes, you can just twist them together. There's a lot of different configurations, many of them pioneered by Bell Atlantic or AT&T and such. But usually, if you want if you wear belt and suspenders, you tend to want to solder those before you seal them up.
Just wanted to check, make sure this was something you guys had run into before. I ran into this with old computers from the 60s and 70s, but I don't see it that often now. But every once in a while, you run into something or an older piece of equipment which has got a wire wrap and solder. It's weird, but we need to know what it is when we encounter it. Going forward, with new equipment, it's usually crimped, sometimes soldered. But for temporary connections, we wire wrap a lot.
Well, yeah, I understand that. Wire wrap was very, very, very popular. I have a whole bunch of wire wrap tools. But, the difference is temporary versus permanent. For temporary, wire wrap is great. Gives you good contact and it lasts long enough. But once you've kind of decided that they're there to stay, that's when you start to dab a little bit of 60-40 solder into it, so you kind of make it a more permanent connection. So I've seen both. Some guys are quick and dirty, and they just leave it as a wire wrap, and it works for them. But most people tend to solder almost anything and everything.
Okay, glad to hear that. We're running into the same thing. I soldered the minimal antenna, the little window antenna, and I really wish I had wire wrapped it because I've been taking it apart so many times.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the point of the exercise. If you are kind of following instructions that you think are incredibly sound, then you could build it so it can't be changed. But, I always advise people when you're building antennas, build them too long because it's a lot easier to shorten a long antenna than lengthen a short antenna. So you should always kind of keep that in the back of your mind because the more complicated a design is, the more likely it will need to be tweaked. And so make it as tweakable without having to, throw too much stuff away.
Looks like we were talking over each other. I heard the tail end of your comment. This is good. My minimal antenna is now in the window between the window screen, which is non-conductive, and the window itself. When the window is closed, I'm finding I'm not getting any connection to the repeater from within the room. When the window is open, I'm able to reach the repeater. When I move the antenna between the screen and the window is closed, I can reach the repeater. So this is good.
Okay, that's interesting. My guess would be there's probably infrared going into your house, but also reflects RF going out of your window pane.
Agree with you. I replaced these windows were replaced in August, and I suspect it's a film. I wish I knew how to measure it. Any ideas?
Well, unfortunately, the only way I know is to get some kind of infrared detector and infrared source. Infrared sources aren't that difficult. There are light-emitting diodes. A lot of light-emitting diodes will emit infrared. The tricky part is being able to calibrate some detection device so that you could measure the change in intensity, the decibel loss going through that layer. That's where the rubber meets the road, I'm afraid.
Okay, I think I know how to build one of those. It's been a while, but I think I know where to start. The other question I had was regarding toroids. I'm pulling a power supply from an old computer, and I'm wondering if those toroids are salvageable.
Well, they might be. The big question I would have is what is their mixture type, because different mixture types have different permeabilities and are better used in certain ranges of frequencies. And if you don't know what the ferrite is, it's not that easy to measure that as well. It's probably not worth the effort. I mean, you could try it as an experiment, and if it works for you, great. But, you know, at the back of your head, understand that it might be completely inadequate for your particular needs. You might be hoping to use it at a frequency range where it saturates that particular type of mixture.
Good advice. I'll try to salvage it and then do some quick testing and see whether it's useful or not. But mainly it's an eyeball, see whether it's marked. A lot of these guys are not marked.
Yes, I have bumped into very few toroids that are marked as far as mixture type. You know, some people can tell the difference. It's a little bit easier if, rather than being a toroid, if it's a split toroid in a, you know, one of the ferrite clamps. I have a lot of those. And the internal color and you know, some look more like a reflecting piece of metal than others, gives you a little bit more information. But I don't know of any that have the numbers stamped on them. I wish they did. I wish it was a standard practice, but it doesn't seem to be, at least in the materials that I've worked with.
I work a lot with older computers and older pieces of equipment, so anytime I'm opening a box, I'm not really sure what's inside it. I have to test everything. It's like, well, this is what was stock, but somebody may have made modifications over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yes, it's all a mystery. And I know guys who love mysteries. They love challenges. You know, other people, you know, just want stuff to work. So it's doable, I'm sure. They probably have somewhat specific permeabilities at certain frequencies. If you have the proper test equipment, it probably isn't that difficult. But, you know, with the rudimentary stuff that most amateur radio operators have, that would be kind of difficult. Not impossible, I'm sure. A good VNA might get you there with a little bit of a resource of using the internet of what to look for and how to configure a couple of loops of a standard size piece of wire and then check what the inductance is at a given frequency. So it's probably doable, but I don't know of anyone who's done it lately.
Thank you so much for the guidance on this. By the way, can you give me a signal check? Because I can hear you clearly. There's a little bit of background noise, but I'm assuming I'm getting out. Are you having difficulty hearing me or not?
No, I'm hearing you fine. Keep in mind, unfortunately, the way that I have it maneuvered is I'm actually operating through a separate EchoLink node in my shack while I'm running the EchoLink node for the clubs. So this is going through EchoLink as well. But there's a little background noise, but otherwise I hear you well.
Hey, thank you so much. Also for the gentleman who I heard earlier who was on a mag loop, I heard him very strongly. So that's a good signal.
Okay, very good. Thank you for participating tonight. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. You're welcome to join us for our future nets. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. If anyone else has anything to say, any questions, comments, subjects, please feel free, hit the push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign. Going, going, gone. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be March 1st, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with details of logging into the meeting. We also have what we call a hybrid meeting, which is that one of our club members, William, AC2ZB, offers his establishment for a limited number of walk-in members for a meeting, and they're connected via Zoom to the rest of us who are connected via Zoom. And so we have a virtual and eyeball meeting simultaneously. So you can find out the details on our website. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for a required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from about 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, and this technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. It's approximately on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. We do a little bit of a shuffle to the right or a shuffle to the left. If someone in Europe is operating on that frequency and we hear them, we don't want to interfere with them. Good amateur radio practices and all. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet as well as our 10-meter net. You just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com and it will take you to a page that you can click and you can hear the audio stream coming out of my shack. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, it's time to roll this all up, but we'll be back March 8th to do it all over again, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks again to all the people that participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a safe couple of weeks. And we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS Clear.